Happy holidays and welcome to the Rob Aguilar Show on Radio Free Brooklyn. Today we have a great show lined up. We have two interviews in store. In the first half of the show, we have authors Susan Pease Goudois and Vicky Larson. They are the authors of a great book called The New I Do. And this book is available at Amazon. They created this concept called parenting marriage. And what that entails is couples who are married who, for whatever reason, decide that they don't want to be together romantically anymore. And they decide that they're going to separate, but they're going to still live in the same house. And they give us insight on how couples can do this successfully. In the second half of the show, we have another author. Her name is Rain Lee, and she also has a book out there called, now pay attention, I think you're going to find this very, very interesting. The title of her book is Squirting, It's Easier Than You Think. Now, what do you think that's about? Okay, so this book is also available at Amazon. And what she's going to do is she's going to share her knowledge and give us some tips on how women can bring themselves to squirting and having intense orgasms. So I think this is a great way to end 2015. And I think you're really, really going to enjoy both these interviews. But before we get started, I'd like to remind you really quickly about our sponsors. We have Rhone Jewelry. You can find them over at www.roanjewelry.com together. That's roanjewelry.com. They have great gifts. And in the next couple of days, they're going to have shopping specials specifically for the show's listeners. And they'll have like a hashtag RAS. So when you go to their website, look for those, and those will be items especially priced for listeners of the show. Now, if you want to get in touch with me, shoot me an email to robaguilarshow@gmail.com, and that's AGUILAR. So it's robaguilarshow@gmail.com. Let me know about your comments, suggestions, if you'd like to be on the show, or if there's a topic that you'd like for us to cover, let me know. All right, so we have a great show lined up. Stick around. You do not want to be left out.
From A1 Studios in Sunset Park, Brooklyn, New York, this is the Rob Aguilar Show.
Susan, Vicky, welcome.
Thank you, Rob. Nice to be here.
Thank you, Rob.
I came across a fascinating article, Parenting Marriage. And this is a concept that when I was reading the article and I said, wow, there are so many marriages out there where people are staying together and they stay together for the most part, from what I hear, for the kids, for the children. They're bickering, they're fighting, they're yelling at each other. And it's a very hostile and unhealthy environment to raise children in. But your concept kind of negates all that and creates a different environment where you are staying together for the children, but it becomes a healthier environment for all parties involved. How did this concept come about?
I am a therapist, and I have been working with couples who have been either contemplating divorce or in the process of divorce for about 15 years now. And something that happened about 5 years ago was I had one couple that just simply didn't want a divorce. Nobody wanted to miss tucking the kids in at night. But they also didn't want to stay married. And we came up with a plan where they could divide their house and they could stay living in the house. They were actually wonderful co-parents. They just didn't want to be romantic partners anymore. And so they divided the house and they maintained this relationship. And I helped them, what I call, change their job description so that they understood that their role had shifted from being romantic partners to now simply co-parents and providing a stable house for their children.
How do you introduce such a concept to the children?
I think basically just be honest about what's happening, and you don't have to say mom and dad aren't intimate partners anymore, but you can say something like, you know, we're changing our relationship and we're going to be more friends now. And kids don't have to get the whole thing. I think what's important is just not to lie to kids, not to try to pretend that something's going on when it isn't, because children see through that. And when parents are not fully honest, it teaches kids not to trust their own perceptions.
Do you even think it's worth it to tell children, try to explain this to them, or should you just kind of let it be and they might not even notice things have changed anyway?
Well, that's true. And I think that it really depends on each couple's circumstances. If the children ask, certainly you want to tell them what's going on. And not every situation do you have to make such an announcement. Maybe it never was an intimate marriage to begin with. But the thing about what Vicky and I are proposing, and in particular with the parenting marriage that I propose with couples, is that it's a conscious decision rather than a default mode that you just landed on. That we want people to be having conversations and be in agreement about this arrangement.
Right. And Rob, also parents, people who want to have children can actually go into the marriage that way. And we met couples who were like that, who are saying, we're committing to stay together for 18 years till our child is launched. And we're going to do this, this, and this. They kind of wrote out a contract of how they're going to raise the child and what they're going to do. And so, again, yeah, it is a very conscious decision.
So they'll go into this beforehand.
Right. And actually, we found websites that are like Match.com, but they are for co-parenting people. It's men and women who want to be parents. They don't want to raise children alone necessarily, but they're also not necessarily looking for a romantic partner. They're looking for a co-parent. And based on their values and their ideas of raising a child, they kind of come up with a plan. Are we going to live together or are we going to live separately? But here's how we're going to divide the finances and the responsibilities. And as anyone who's tried to raise a child alone, it's challenging and it's expensive. But co-parenting gives an entirely different twist on that.
Wow, that's very interesting. That's almost like an arranged marriage that you hear about in some cultures.
Absolutely. That was actually the most shocking piece of information that we got when we were doing the research for the new I Do. I had never heard of such websites. But, you know, what I think is happening to marriage in general and divorce for that matter is that it's becoming more of a spectrum of choices rather than a black and white. You're either in the marriage or you're not.
Just in general, marriages or the way humans interact with each other is so complex to a certain degree where, and you hear so many statistics with regards to divorce rates. I heard a couple of years ago that 50% of marriages ended in divorce. I don't know how accurate that is today, but that is kind of like a scary statistic, which kind of tells me, do humans even belong, or couples, do we even belong married? Because of that supposed high divorce rate.
That statistic is a myth, and that was recently debunked by two economists, Justin Wolfers. He's a University of Michigan economist, and his wife, Betsy Stevenson, is in the Obama administration as an economist. And there was a huge spike in divorce rates right after no-fault divorce became the norm. And then that kind of tapered off. So according to Justin Wolfers, about 70% of marriages that began in the 1990s reached their 15th anniversary. So, and he says if those who married in the 2000s, if the trends continue, that nearly two-thirds of marriages will never involve a divorce. So, but that seems to be happening mostly among college-educated people, people who have high school educations or less than a full-year degree tend to be divorcing and remarrying a little bit more. But you talk about, you know, whether we are made to be long-term. Helen Fisher, who does love research for Match.com, said that back in the hunter and gathering days, there were multiple pair bondings. And she believes that we're going to be seeing that again. And already that is indeed so. The Pew came out with some numbers not too long ago that said 4 out of 10 newlyweds in 2013 had been married before. 40% is pretty high.
That is high.
Yeah. I think the good news, though, for couples who have children and who are considering divorcing but really torn about whether they should do that and what the repercussions will be on the kids, there are more options. And I wanted to comment on something you said earlier, Rob, about the fighting. And there's tons of research out there showing that it isn't divorce that harms children. It is parents fighting. And so parents can stay together, as mine did, for 10 years longer than they should have, and continue to fight and cause more damage than if they split and went their separate ways amicably. But obviously the best scenario for kids is if parents can stay together and not fight and figure out how to do that. And one of the ways that the parenting marriage serves them is when you take love out of the equation and that pressure that comes with being a spouse, that as we define it now, that is, it makes all the difference in the world. And I have now worked with several couples who have transformed their marriage from a romantic-based marriage into a parenting marriage. And it entails some work. You have to figure out the rules that you're going to go by, but it is doable if you get along well enough.
Rob, I was going to add that maybe couples who are transforming their marriage may not come back romantically, but from people we heard from our studies around the world who were in arranged marriages, they talk, and they went in without love, without romantic love. They said when they saw their husband caring for their kids and going out and working and doing all of these things, that was love to them. So they fell in love with this person who was being kind to the children they had. And so maybe the people who come together as co-parents might fall in love that way if they see that love building that way.
I think something happens when couples work together and everything is kind of running smoothly. Of course, in a perfect ideal world, it would be like that every day. But I can speak for, like, I guess, personal experience. When my wife and I were having our first child, and I saw her go through labor and deliver that baby like a champion, and we were working together. I was there and I was part of the delivery as much as I possibly could. Something happened, like something triggered, like I saw her in a completely other different light. Like I was in love with her, but I was in love with her like 10 times more because here she is giving birth to our child, and she had made a commitment to not use any of the painkillers, any of the drugs. She was going to do this as naturally as possible. And we worked together as a team during that labor, and it just kind of brought us even more together. So I kind of see when, and I see when people, even when couples like go to the gym and work out together or do something athletic like a race or take on a project together, it almost kind of brings them closer. And I can see why in those cultures where they didn't start out loving each other, but as time went on, they saw how they worked as a team and they did things for each other. It brought them closer, and then love was born.
Well, paradoxically, the very things that often bring couples together at some point are the things that they're fighting over. So it's a very tricky line to maintain. And there are lots of books out there about how to keep your relationship as the primary focus. And that's great. It gets very complicated, especially when you have a second or a third child and life does its thing and throws you curveballs. And so it is possible. Obviously, we see people do it. But, you know, it just gets trickier.
Part of the reason why we really encourage anyone going into any of the marriages that we have in the book is we encourage them to create a contract. Because when you talk about a lot of these things, typically the things that make couples fight, you know, chores and parenting and this and that, if you write things down, you're really giving a lot of thought. You're coming to agreements early on. You're seeing some potential rough areas. And of course, you know, things will change, but part of the contract is also that you spend time to renegotiate it. You check in every once in a while. How is this going? What do we need to change? And it holds each of you accountable, and it's easier not to just fall apart when things get a little bit rough about parenting or so on.
Is children the number one reason why couples get divorced?
I actually don't have that particular stat in front of me, but I know that the top three reasons are money, children, and oh gosh, what's the third? Money, children.
Infidelity?
Infidelity, for sure. Money, children, and I can't think of the third one. So maybe it is infidelity.
So would you say it's in that order? Money, children, and infidelity?
Kids. Yeah. I think kids are definitely one of the higher reasons.
Wow.
That parents fight and break up.
Is it because they add stress to the relationship?
Absolutely. One of the dynamics that is kind of cliche, but is something I see certainly a lot, is the primary caregiver, which tends to be the woman, has a stronger bond with the children. And so the other spouse feels left out and feels pushed out. So whether that is, it can be the same dynamic in a same-sex marriage, but whoever is the primary caregiver is bonding more with the children, and the other spouse feels pushed away and distant. And of course, the issue of running after kids all day long, the last thing you want to do at the end of the day is have sex. And so when sex falls away from a marriage, it can make the people feel less close and less intimate, obviously.
The research has proven that the first 2 years after a child is born, marital satisfaction goes down. And for men, it lingers a little bit longer. So, and perhaps because of what Susan brought up, is that often the baby is a little bit closer to the mother, and he's maybe lost his playmate and his, sexual partner for a little bit. But also, I did some research that's not in the book. Children are born with problems, autism. Jenny McCarthy, a few years ago, when she wrote a book, said that the divorce rate among parents who have autistic children could be as high as 80%. That number was disputed, but it helped the National Autism Association create a program to help families with autistic children so that they could afford marital counseling. So ADHD, autism, there just was a huge story this week of a mother who's divorced her husband in Australia because he did not want to give up their child who was born with Down syndrome, and she did. And so children come in all flavors, and that can create stress if your child is not born what we would consider, quote unquote, a normal child. So when there's disabilities or so on, that adds stress to families.
Yeah, but even just having children, I think, is just stressful in itself. It's being responsible for other human beings.
Yes.
It's a big burden when you think about what's involved, because here you have the ability to either form this child to grow up and be a healthy individual, or you can completely ruin this kid and he's going to need therapy for the rest of his life. And it all falls on parenting and how that child is raised. So I can see how that is a lot of pressure. But I wanted to touch on the bonding aspect of things that were just brought up a little bit ago, where I guess the child is bonding more with the primary caretaker and the other parent feels left out. Is that a real perception? Is that bond really that strong, or can the other parent do something to feel part of the equation?
Well, Vicky may want to speak to that because she has children and I don't, but I will say that from my experience professionally, I do think it is a real change in the attachment, that the attachment becomes less to the significant other and more on the children. But Vicky, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, I won't speak of my personal experience, but I will say that there is a movement to involve men more in the childbirth, and they're realizing that men also have postpartum depression. That's never really been, that hasn't been discussed before. And so there is a new consciousness about dads and what happens to men when they become fathers. Their testosterone levels lower, lessens. So there is a bunch of new research, and I imagine there's going to be more and more about how that is impacting fathers and ways to be proactive about that so that men don't get lost in that process. I think we're going to see more and more of attention being paid to dads. And, you know, also there are about 2 million stay-at-home fathers in the United States right now. Some of them became stay-at-home dads by default. They lost their jobs during the Great Recession and haven't really quite bounced back. And maybe the wife has, or their significant other. Maybe that will change it as well. And I hope so, because I think it's important. You know, dads play a really important role in the development of their children, especially daughters, especially daughters.
I can only compare it to my situation. Our son is only a year and 6 months old, and my wife nurses, or was nursing from the very beginning. So we kind of had, I guess, an agreement on who was going to do what. So she does the nursing. We weren't formula feeding him or anything like that. I couldn't bond with the feeding, but I was given the task, so conveniently, of changing diapers. So I was in charge of changing diapers. She was in charge of the feeding. And I became really quickly an expert, and I never thought that I was going to be able to do this. But I could change a diaper that was pooped completely in the dark, and change it and clean it. And that was, in a weird way, kind of my way of bonding with my son, I guess, early on. And now we kind of divide the chores. He goes to an art class, a music class, and we kind of, I'll take him to his art class, she'll take him to his music class, and then we're bonding on our way there and while we're there. So I think, but there are ways of figuring out how everyone can be included in the process so nobody feels left out.
Yeah, and I think the key there, it sounds like you and your wife are having some conscious conversations, but that's exactly what Vicki and I are proposing, is that we really want people to have more conversations about every aspect of marriage and raising kids together. And so that's true in any number of the other marriages that we uncovered that are going on out there, such as living apart together. So, you know, it doesn't matter what flavor of marriage or what your focus is, as long as you're both communicating and making agreements consciously.
A lot of couples are choosing to remain child-free. And that is addressed in the book as well, because their experiences are entirely different, and the things that they're going to argue about or bond with are going to be different than people who decide to have children.
Infidelity was also brought up, for the most part, at least many things that I've read. Men and women tend to not be faithful based on different things. And maybe you can share some light on that. When a woman cheats, I think it's for very different reasons when, for the most part, in the general sense, when compared to the reasons why men cheat.
I'm going to disagree with you, Rob, on that. That's what a lot of people and so-called experts want to tell us, that women do it for love and emotional reasons and men do it just for purely sex. And, you know, as long as people keep saying that, then people will still believe that. I don't believe that's necessarily so. But we don't really get into why people are cheating. We are looking at the fact that even though huge percentages say sexual infidelity is wrong in a marriage, we have a high infidelity rate. And it's hard to really get a grasp on that because it's self-reported, and not everyone wants to tell the truth about what they're doing. So rates are somewhere about 20% of the population to 70 or 80%. We don't really know. But regardless of what the rate is, we all know infidelity exists. We probably have experienced it in friends or families or neighbors. We know it exists. So whatever the percentage is irrelevant. The fact is, maybe sexual fidelity shouldn't necessarily be a part of a marriage. Monogamy is assumed, but monogamy is a choice. And a lot of people don't talk about, am I good at monogamy? And I don't think couples tend to talk about that. Or are we going to be monogamous? Why might we choose to be monogamous? Are we good at monogamy? And we hope to get couples to have those conversations so that they, if they choose monogamy, they're actually choosing it. It's not just an assumption.
And another thing that Helen Fisher just came out in an article talking about is that her prediction is that we as a species are going to get back to much more serial monogamy. If indeed, you know, we are monogamous at all, that maybe we aren't meant, after all, to be with one person till death do us part. And we don't advocate for or against open marriages. We just say this is an option that fits certain people. Right now we have a one-size-fits-all model for how it is to be a spouse and a parent. And so we're suggesting that maybe there should be more sizes to choose from because there are so many variations on who we are as people and our lifestyles. We have so many more choices today.
I know a lot of guys who will say that biology simply does not allow them to be monogamous, and we were never meant to be. And maybe it's their way, you know, how they justify what they do. But there's guys out there that that's what they believe. It's biologically not possible for a man to be only with one woman.
Well, if you read, there are two books by Luann Brizendine. She wrote The Female Brain and The Male Brain. And there is some truth to the fact that the sex center in the male brain is much larger than the woman's, and the verbal center in the woman's brain is a lot larger than the male's. So there are some physiological differences, and I do believe we are wired for certain tasks.
That said, whatever our biology is telling us, we have a brain that can override the biology. If you don't want to cheat, you don't have to cheat. And so, but if you're not good at monogamy, then why not be open, honest, and transparent about that? And that is what we are, you know, advocating for, that people address what they know about themselves or what they might suspect about themselves, or at least be willing to explore, why am I monogamous?
And so do you think it's okay for a man, before he gets married with a woman, to say, you know what, I have a really tough time being with one woman, and I'm really not good at this whole monogamy thing. We can get married, but be warned that I might mess around with other women out there.
No. That's not how I would want it to go. But certainly, I think, and I think a lot of couples would not get together if that's how one person presented it and said, I'm really not good at monogamy, because he or she who says that knows that most likely this person they're interested in romantically is going to run away, unless the other person is also open to consensual non-monogamy. So you would really need to find someone who is interested in that. Or
talk about finding your soulmate, huh?
Yeah, matching expectations. And I think the scenario that you put out is certainly better than the person knowing it, not saying anything, and then having multiple affairs. That, I mean, the devastation that I've seen from somebody having affairs and being dishonest is way worse, I think, than being open about it in the beginning and saying, this is who I am. I know my limitations. But ideally, it's not, this is how I'm going to be and you need to live with it. It's, this is what I'd like to propose that we both have the option for in our marriage.
Yeah. And then, you know, relationships where one person goes along with it just to appease the other person, that's when people say, oh, well, open relationships don't work. And they probably don't work in the situation because one person is not going into it willingly. It's a big thing to do that. And so you really need to be open, honest, and transparent about that and find somebody who is like-minded about that. And, you know, we interviewed a number of couples who decided to open up their marriage for a while. And they felt that they had done something very brave to do that. And they knew that they were taking risks and they pushed themselves to explore the levels of their jealousy and this and that. And they came out of it actually closer and better. And then they were making a conscious decision. Yeah, I'm choosing monogamy. While there were things about non-monogamy that I liked, I prefer this. And so that's great. And, you know, let's be honest. There are many, many ways to damage a relationship that are not, sexual. You can be critical of your partner. You can be emotionally abusive. So there are many, many ways to be horrible to your partner other than infidelity. But why even have to go there? Why not just start the relationship being open, honest about, do we do well with monogamy? Why do we want it?
Another thing that I hear often, that relationships are work, that you have to work at a relationship to make it better. I mean, work is work. Why should I have to come home from work and work at a relationship? Do you ever hear anything like that?
It does. I'm glad you're bringing this point up because I think that there is, it's not work, it's how much work, I think, is really a better focus of this question. I think there's a romantic ideal out there that if the relationship is the right one, it's easy and there's no work. And I feel like that is not fair. You know, people think that, I had to come home and have a serious conversation and it got hard and therefore I shouldn't be in this relationship anymore. I think that, as we said earlier, life throws curveballs, relationships are complicated. It does take work. It takes, you know, effort. It takes conscious focus. I think if it becomes more work and difficult, you know, task than you're getting enjoyment out of it, that's when you may want to reevaluate. But I just think that it's, you know, not fair to assume that it should never be any work or that it doesn't take effort.
I have a problem with the word work. I say, you know, there has been some research of what makes a successful and happy marriage. And a lot of it is things like appreciation. If you want to consider appreciation of your spouse's work, I suppose you can frame it that way. But when you are appreciative of your spouse's efforts and note it, that makes your spouse feel good. I'm not sure that that's work. Complacency is a relationship killer. It gets boring. It gets static. So some of the recent research indicates that the couples that do things together, learn new things together, tend to have happier, more successful partnerships. Is that work or is that just an action that is bonding you? I don't know. You can call it work.
That actually sounds like fun. You're going out there and doing things together. That's fun. That sounds like fun to me.
When Vicky was talking, I got an image of a plant. And, you know, that you wouldn't get a plant and never feed or water it. And whether feeding or watering feels laborious or fun. That is really your perspective. But I really appreciate what Vicky's saying about the language.
Some plants are cacti and they need a lot of water.
That's right. Know what you're buying.
Exactly.
So you have to know your partner and your each other's needs and you know, act accordingly, I think.
I think what happens, something that was brought up before, life happens and it throws you a curveball. And I've seen situations where, let's say, someone loses their job, the wife loses the job or the husband loses the job, and things get tough. Money gets tough. That's what puts the stress on the marriage. And then one is ready to go because I just can't deal with this stress. This is too much. And I think that people aren't willing necessarily to tough it out. It's not so much where it's work, but if you're really there as a team, then you have to kind of handle things accordingly when life happens and not necessarily be ready to bail out and take the easy way out.
Well, one of the things that we discovered is that there are basically three different types of marriers. There are the marriers who will not divorce no matter what. There are the people who think marriage is, you know, a light commitment and they could get out anytime. And then by far the majority of the people are those who take the commitment seriously and really struggle with the decision of whether to leave or not. I do think there are more people today that don't see marriage as a lifelong commitment. But again, you know, one of the things that Vicky and I talk about is the only measure right now that we have of a successful marriage is the longevity. And when Brad Pitt left Jennifer Aniston, he said, "I feel like we had a very successful marriage." The Gores felt like they had a very successful marriage. Because it ends does not equal failure, and we really don't like that term, but it shouldn't be the only thing that we measure a marriage by, I believe.
That's a great point, because I've heard many couples, when they get divorced, they consider it a failure.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe they raised great kids. Maybe they did a lot of things together, but for some reason it had to come to an end, and it doesn't necessarily mean that it was a failure. It just wasn't fit for you at that moment.
Right. And change and grow. Yeah.
Right. And that's why, you know, we really do encourage in the book, regardless of the model, that you create a marital contract, that you actually do talk about some potential things that could happen. Let's say there's a career move and someone wants to move. It's a great opportunity across the country. Does he have to give up his career for her, you know, to move with her? Like, you kind of talk those things out. What are we willing to do? What are we not going to do? How are we going to handle it if some of these kind of potential things are going to come up? And also to constantly reassess, not constantly, but every so often, reassess the contract and decide, is this marriage a success by what we set out to accomplish in it? So we do talk about renewable contracts in there. If you've raised your children and you now want to end the marriage because you basically did the goal of the marriage, that's not a failure. You know, that's not a failure.
Where can people buy this awesome book?
People can buy the awesome book. We have a website called thenewidobook.com. And we have links to Amazon and Goodreads. Vicky, do you happen to have the information from Seal Press on the special that they're offering?
I think it's actually on the Seal Press website.
Or they can go to our Facebook page.
They can go to our Facebook page.
Which is also called The New I Do.
Right. And Seal Press, if you go to their website, which is sealpress.com, they will tell you that you can enter on Goodreads, a contest to win a copy of the book, and through March 15th, with various retailers, you can download an ebook for $1.99, which is a special price. You can follow us on Twitter at The New I Do, and we're on Amazon and in bookstores.
And we love people's feedback, even if it is disagreeing with some of the premises, but we really welcome all conversations about how marriage needs to evolve.
Susan Pease-Goudois, Vicky Larson, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. This was a lot of fun, very informative, and I think we all learned a lot.
Well, thank you so much, Rob.
Yeah, thank you, Rob. Really great questions. Thank you.
Thank you, guys. Rain, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
You have a very interesting topic that you're going to talk to us about, and it has to do with squirting.
Yes.
And it's easier than you think. Why is squirting such an important thing, in your opinion, as far as sexual health? People just assume that squirting is just pee. It's just urine. And it's just maybe a reaction that takes place during intercourse, a sensation that a woman has, and she just pees all over the place.
Well, some people have that assumption, but there's a lot of people who don't feel that way about it. And my book was partially why I wrote the book. A big part of why I wrote the book is because there isn't good information out there on the subject. And most of the information that is out there is from the porn industry. So it's not very accurate, educational. A lot of what happens in the porn industry is theatrics. So it's, you know, what you see there is not a true representation of squirting anyways. So we need more education on what this is and that, you know, women can do this, they enjoy it, men enjoy it, and why we should be doing it, I guess.
Why should we be doing it?
It's pleasurable. I mean, for both men and women, men, that's like this huge accomplishment for them when they can get a woman to achieve that, because normally when a woman orgasms, you don't really see any evidence of it, and sometimes you don't know if it's even happened. And so for a man, that's huge evidence to him that, oh, okay, I did something right. And then for a woman, it's a very pleasurable orgasm. Most people that have them would say that that's kind of the height of an orgasm for them.
But can a woman have an orgasm without squirting?
Yes, absolutely. There's different types of orgasms that women can have anyways. You have clitoral, you have G-spot, you have kind of a combination. And so, yes, I mean, women don't have to squirt to have an orgasm. And sometimes when they squirt, they're not even having a full-on orgasm either.
Is the word squirting, is that the correct term? It has like this fetish sound to it,
yeah.
You know, like you mentioned before in the porn industry. Is it a true ejaculation in the sense like the way a man ejaculates? What exactly happens? What causes the squirting? What is it? Let's dig deep
okay.
into that.
Okay. Well, first of all, yes, I would prefer the term female ejaculation over squirting, but everyone knows it is squirting. So if you're going to write a book about it, you've got to use that word. And that's just, you know, clearly the porn industry has termed it that way. And so they have such a huge influence, of course, in our society. And that's what people know it as. But yeah, I mean, there is a lot we don't know about squirting yet. There's been a lot of studies done over the years that haven't really concluded everything. So admittedly, we don't know everything. What we do know is that it comes from the Skene's gland. That's where the fluid actually builds up. And the Skene's gland is by the G-spot. And the G-spot, of course, is the equivalent of a male prostate. So when a woman squirts, there is glucose in that fluid as well as a prostatic enzyme. We don't know a ton about all that's happening there. But that's kind of what we do know.
So there's no urine in there.
Well, there's conflicting information about that. What everyone has concluded is that the substance that comes out is not urine. We're not talking about pure urine. Because in urine, you don't have glucose, you don't have the prosthetic enzyme that you're getting in that fluid. But there is urea that comes in, that's in the squirting fluid often. But urea is not urine. Urine is made up of urea as well as other things.
So there's a gland that makes this. And is it stored somewhere like the same way as with men and how semen is stored in the testicles? I mean, what happens if a woman doesn't ejaculate? Does it stay there? Does it, you know, like for example, if a man doesn't ejaculate, doesn't have sex, or doesn't, the semen still in the testicles until he makes new semen, but is it stored anywhere?
I don't know that we know that exactly about it as far as it being stored. We know that when a woman ejaculates and or doesn't ejaculate but is having sex and those chemicals don't come out, that there's a retrograde ejaculation where those chemicals stay in, but they will come out in the urine after she has sex.
I wonder why it took so long for people to look into this. Are doctors looking into this? Is this something that's being studied in the medical community, or do people just not care?
It's studied rarely. There isn't a lot of great information
why?
Out there. I don't know. I mean, I think that there's enough of a joke behind it, honestly, that people don't take it very seriously. Or I don't think that... Sometimes there's as much focus on women's orgasms either, or I mean, I don't think women sometimes focus on it enough. So that's part of the problem. And yeah, I mean, I don't have all the answers why we're not studying this more. But you know, the latest study that came out was just this big study about, oh, it's just pee, you know, and that kind of wiped the slate clean of any seriousness, you know, of actually looking more into it. But that study only had 7 participants. So it was a very small sample size. And even what it concluded was not, it even said that the chemicals were present in their samples, you know, the after ejaculation chemicals, the prostate enzyme, the glucose. So it's, yeah, there's not great information out there.
So how did you get involved with this squirting phenomenon? What about it interested you? Why study? Why look into it?
Well, it's something that happened to me about 6 years ago, and it was a very random occurrence with my ex-husband. And we were excited about it because it was a great experience, but afterwards we didn't know what it was and we were really confused. So I started doing a lot of research, mainly online, because there's really nowhere else that I could find information. And I kind of dug deep, and that began years worth of research that, you know, I looked into. And then it was kind of a light bulb moment, you know, that the whole thing about write what you know. And I felt like I had a lot of information that no one else really did. And there wasn't any place that all that information was put together. So I decided to write this book, and I did. So it's out there.
That was the first time that had ever happened to you?
Yes.
Is it one of those things that kind of snowballs? Like, for example, it happens that first time, and do you learn how to do this where you can eventually squirt every time you orgasm?
I don't know if anyone can do it every time they orgasm, but you definitely become more in touch with what your body needs to do it, and it's easier to get there. So I think, yeah, definitely once it happens, for the most part, with most women, it becomes easier to obtain.
Let's get into that, because the title of your book, Squirting, It's Easier Than You Think. How so? How is it easy? Is it something that a woman has to talk herself into it, think about it, think and ye shall squirt, or what?
Well, it's different for each woman, but yes, there is definitely some tricks that if you use those, it's going to be helpful. And my book lists 10 tips, but I also have a squirt school. It's an online school. And it lists, or it teaches you not just these kind of basic main tips, but it also teaches you positions, masturbation techniques, and just the history. It teaches pretty much everything you wanted to know about squirting. So
So basically, it's a squirting 101 course.
Exactly.
Okay. Yep. I know we want everyone to go out and buy this book, but could you share maybe a tip or two on how a woman might go about talking herself to squirting, or what can she do? You said there's some tricks.
Yep.
Could you share a trick or two?
Yes, absolutely.
To kind of give us a little teaser about what's in the book.
Okay. Well, first of all, hydration is really, really important. You got to start there, because if you don't have the fluid in your body, you're not going to ejaculate. So I would say that's one of the main tips. As well, it's all about relaxing and not letting – women tend to stay in their head too much when it comes to any type of orgasm. So it's really about just letting go and letting all the sensations go, you know, keeping everything very loose and relaxed. And then another key is G-spot stimulation.
If you could describe the difference, since you've experienced squirting and then prior to that had never happened to you, could you describe the difference? Is there a difference in the sensation of the orgasm squirting versus non-squirting?
Absolutely. With squirting, and this, again, will vary with each woman, but in general, myself and I hear a lot of other women, it's a huge release. It's that feeling of what I think men feel when they ejaculate. It's a release. And women don't get that as much when they just have a regular orgasm, but when they actually squirt, they have that same feeling. It's like everything's released from your body. You're just really relaxed and it just feels complete. As well, with a squirting orgasm, it's typically more of an all-body orgasm instead of just being centralized to the clitoral region.
It sounds like it's more intense.
Absolutely.
Is your background in any way medical or...
It's not. It's just me giving the information that I have. I wish that I had more medical, you know, training to go behind this. But I'm the only one that's taking it upon myself to offer much information. So I'm using medical resources and just my own knowledge.
Are you teaching these courses as well?
Yep, the online course I teach, and it's about 2 hours long. People can take it at their own speed and they can do just the sections they want to. It's always available once somebody buys it. So they can purchase it and come back to it in 2 weekends and try some tips or positions or whatever.
So is there actual squirting taking place in these courses?
No. I mean, it's pretty much all text-based. And I mean, there's some just visual slides and things, but for the most part, it's just explaining techniques and background information.
If people want to reach out to you and ask more questions about this, how can we get in touch with you? Do you have a Twitter, Facebook? How do people reach you?
Yeah, I'm on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, YouTube, and on all those, I'm Arthur R. Lee. So on Facebook, it's Arthur R. Lee. On Twitter, it's at Arthur R. Lee. And if you go to my website, www.arthurrlee.com, which is R-L-E-I-G-H, that's going to have links to everything on there. It's going to have links to Squirt School, links to buy the book. Everything's there.
Fantastic. Squirt School. That is an awesome name. So the name of the book is Squirting, It's Easier Than You Think.
Yes.
It's available at Amazon, Barnes & Nobles, on your website. This was very interesting. This was a lot of fun. Rain, thank you so much. We invite everyone to check out this book, Squirting, It's Easier Than You Think. They'll find lots of tips to help you reach this amazing phenomenon. Thank you so much for your time, Rain.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for hanging out. I hope you have a very safe and wonderful New Year's celebration. Stick around. Up next, we have Trippin' Beats. I will see you all in the promised land.